Welcome to the Research Culture Uncovered podcast, where in every episode we explore what is research culture and what should it be. You'll hear thoughts and opinions from a range of contributors to help you change research culture into what you want it to be.
Hello and welcome to the Research Culture Uncovered podcast. I'm your host, Haleth Jaros Griffiths. In this episode, we're asking a deceptively simple question. What actually shapes a researcher? Is it the ideas we pursue, the systems we work within, or the moments, challenges, and people that shape us along the way? Recently, I had the opportunity to be part of a series of sessions with the Worldwide Universities Network, bringing together early career researchers from across the globe to reflect on research vision, impact, careers, and research culture. Across these conversations, colleagues explored some really big questions about research life. But what struck me listening back was how connected they all felt. Again and again, these sessions came back to questions of direction, value, identity, and context. How do researchers make sense of where they're going? How do they communicate the value of their work? How do institutional cultures and wider systems shape that? And how do people stay connected to what matters to them, particularly in the face of uncertainty, rejection, and the realities of research careers? In this episode, I'll be weaving together reflections from colleagues who led those sessions, alongside some of my own thoughts, to explore what it really means to navigate research in today's landscape. One of the strongest themes across the programme was the importance and the difficulty of articulating a research vision. Jim Baxter's session focused on helping researchers start to think about what that vision might look like, not just in terms of the next task or application, but in terms of a longer-term sense of purpose and direction.
What we were trying to do was get people to recognise the value, the importance of having a research vision, and to set them on the road to starting to craft their own research vision. We built into it exercises where they had a go at trying to write a very short research vision. It's really difficult to get past having an initial stab at something. What I think is really needed is people to recognise the value of doing it and then to go away and spend time crafting it. With some researchers, it can take a lifetime of continued crafting, and they never actually get to this, actually pinpoint what it is that their research is about, what they're trying to do with their research.
What I found really interesting in Jim's reflection was the idea that developing a research vision isn't something you just do once and take off. It can take time. And for some people, a lot of time to work out what their research is really about, what kind of impact they want it to have, and how to express that in a way that feels personal and convincing. And that felt especially important in the context of early career research, where it can be hard to look up and think long-term when the immediate pressures are so dominant.
When they start talking about applying for funding, get hung up on what the funding rules are, what the funding will pay for, how much money can they ask for, do they need a project plan, how do they work out what the full economic cost of their proposal is, and get bogged down in the procedural administration and form filling aspects of the proposal, all of which is important because you need to be able to show that you've got a plan and you know what you're going to spend your money on. And I think that can detract from spending the time that's needed on the overall message of the proposal.
That tension really stayed with me. Researchers are often encouraged to think strategically, but they're doing so in context shaped by short-term pressures, funding constraints, and the constant need to prove value. Those procedural elements, the forms, the costing, the logistics are important, but they can sometimes pull attention away from the bigger picture. What is the actual message of the research? Where is it going?
When I talk about research vision, really want people to think about what's going to be, certainly as somebody who's early on in their research careers, is what's going to keep you occupied for the next 30 years? Where do you want to be in 30 years' time? That's what I would like people to get to when they're talking about their visions. But it's really difficult when the next goal is to get the next paper published or get the next research grant application in. But conversely, the thing that might actually win you the next research grant application is that that long-term vision will come through in the application, and people say, yeah, if we fund this now, it's really important and we can see where this is going, not just by the end of the project, but into the future. The other value of developing a research vision as an early career researcher, it can actually cause you to think about, okay, so why am I in research? What do I want to achieve as somebody who does research? Do I actually want to lead applied research? Do I want to lead blue skies research? Do I want to lead research at all? Or do I want to be somebody who enables other people to lead research? I think the more that you can identify what it is that you want out of the future, the easier it is to engage in that as a career. And it tends to be those people who have got a clearer articulation of the vision on their web pages, the ones that tend to float to the top. So many pages, people's individual staff pages or LinkedIn profiles just talk about what they have done, not where they want to go.
What I think this highlights is that research vision isn't just about ambition, it's about clarity. Clarity about what you want to contribute, what kind of research you want to be part of, and what might sustain you over the long term. And that's not always easy to access when the next paper or the next grant feels like the most urgent priority. Value is a word that came up in lots of different ways across these sessions. In Jed Hall's session on impact, that question of value was explored much more explicitly. He was interested in whether people conceptualise impact in the same way. At the level of the individual, the institution, or the country they work in, and what shapes those understandings?
For them as individuals, their discipline played a huge influence on their ranking of impact types. So health researchers tended to prioritise health and wellbeing impact, engineering researchers tended to prioritise economic impact, and for instance, arts and humanities researchers focused on societal and cultural impact. Now that's no surprise, and neither were their responses in assessing the importance of impact in their country's research assessment practices, their funders' policies and programmes, and their institution's strategy. All the responses fell broadly in line with my impression after scan reading the material that I could find in these three areas for all of the 18 Worldwide Universities Network countries.
What I really like about Jed's reflection is that they remind us that impact isn't one fixed thing. What counts as impact depends on a lot of disciplinary norms, institutional priorities, and the wider context researchers are working within. And that matters because researchers aren't just developing their work in isolation. They're doing it with systems that signal what is valued, what is rewarded, and what is seen as meaningful.
The major surprise for me was the ranking of impact types for the country you were working in. I was expecting economic to probably be the most prioritised, no matter what country they were based in, given the quite dominant position this has in most governmental rhetoric across the world. But most responses, no matter the country, focused on health, with only a few picking economic. So was this being driven by the disciplinary biases of the health and engineering researchers and their representation across the countries that were represented? And so this led me to wonder, are researchers dealing with the biases towards different impact types that the countries in which they work have, or are the ones they wish the country had?
That raises a really interesting question. Are researchers responding to the systems they work within, or imagining the kinds of priorities they wish those systems held? Either way, it shows that questions of impact are never neutral. They're shaped by culture, context, and expectation. And that leads naturally into Marjorie Boissignon's session on research culture. Research culture is one of those terms that gets used a lot, but it can still feel quite slippery. Marjorie reflected on the challenge of designing a session on research culture that would make sense at a global level, across different institutions, countries, and contexts.
I would say for me, there were three main challenges. The first one is that the UK has a lot of national and sector drivers, and of course at Leeds we have our own institutional drivers. So although I could use some of our examples here at Leeds to illustrate the session, I wanted to make sure that I would find global drivers of research culture that people might have heard of beyond just the San Francisco Declaration of Research Assessment, and that they could relate to. The second challenge, then also linked to the first one, is that research culture is very much an umbrella term that is not always used as such. So there will be a lot of jargon around it, a lot of initiatives supporting positive research culture, not necessarily labeled research culture, and like terms like open research, responsible research and innovation, research integrity, research ethics, reward and recognition, all of those, when looking for global drivers and then looking more closely to encourage people to search for and be aware of these drivers at their institution, I had to remove that jargon and give people examples of what RC could look like in real life at their institutions under other names, then lead them to reflect on where those initiatives and positive support for research culture could be, so that they could engage with it and also empower them to proactively contribute to a positive research culture at their institution globally.
What I thought was especially important here was the point that many of the things we might associate with positive research culture might not always be labelled as such. So part of the challenge is helping people recognise it in practice, in the systems and initiatives around them, and in the everyday realities of how research is supported and experienced.
The third challenge was to showcase how diverse and rich, in a way, research cultures are on a global scale, and how different they will be from institution to institution within one country and then across countries, and the influence that it has on collaborations when you approach people in different institutions and people nationally and people internationally to collaborate with you, how to be mindful of other people's culture.
That felt like such an important reminder that research culture is not one thing. It isn't fixed and it isn't universal. It's shaped by local context, language, priorities, and relationships. And that has real implications for how people work together. Another thread running through the programme was the importance of creating space for reflection. That came through strongly in Taryn's careers session, where she invited participants to think about their values, alternative pathways, and what meaningful career planning might look like.
So this is the third time I've run a session for one, and I really enjoy running these sessions actually, which is interesting because generally as a facilitator, I do tend to find online facilitation a little bit trickier. We often, and I'm talking about myself and also colleagues in other institutions, struggle with engagement when it comes to online facilitation, with people having their cameras turned off, not engaging. And in this respect, the one webinars can present a challenge because of the size of the audience, we literally can't see anyone. Everyone's cameras and mics are turned off. And so for me, this always puts me in a position where I am encouraged to be much more creative about how to engage members of the audience and how to ensure engagement without actually being able to see anyone physically. So that means things like using the chat more, using polling software, using questions that'll help people to think.
I thought this was a really nice counterpoint because it brought us back to the practical question of how you actually create reflective spaces in these kinds of programmes. From the feedback, it was clear that people really valued that. The value of being asked good questions, being given time to think, being able to connect ideas back to their own context.
I'm always really impressed with how engaged the audience is, how much engagement we see in the chat, how much people are willing to get involved when all they can do is type or answer a poll. Even with all that, which seems so simple, it feels like we always get a really good conversation going.
I think that also says something quite hopeful about researchers' appetite for these conversations. Even in large online spaces, people are willing to engage when the questions feel relevant and meaningful. Another dimension of this came through in the session by Ruth Winden on LinkedIn and professional visibility. While it focused on something quite practical, how researchers present themselves online, it also raised some deeper questions about identity, visibility, and how researchers communicate their work beyond traditional academic spaces. What I found interesting here is that, much like the conversations around vision and impact, it wasn't just about what you share, but how and why. How do you present yourself in a way that feels authentic? How do you make your work visible without feeling like you're selling yourself? And how do you balance professional identity with personal voice? It felt like another example of how researchers are navigating not just the work itself, but how the work is seen, understood, and connected to wider audiences. Listening across all of these reflections, what stood out to me was that they weren't just sessions about skills. They were sessions about how researchers make sense of themselves and their work. Dream session invited people to talk about long-term direction and the challenge of articulating their vision. Dredge raised important questions about what counts as impact and who gets to define it. Marjorie's highlighted the complexity and diversity of research culture across global context. Taryn's reminded us how powerful it can be to create space for reflection. And Ruth's brought in that layer of visibility, how researchers present and position themselves in wider spaces. Taken together, they point to something bigger. Researchers are not only being asked to produce knowledge, they're also being asked to explain why their work matters, to situate themselves within complex systems, and to make decisions about the kind of researcher and perhaps the kind of person they want to be. And alongside all of that, there's also something more human running through it. One of the things that stood out to me most from my own session on handling rejection was just how universal these experiences are. No matter where you're based in the world, we all respond to rejection in a very human way. There's that initial emotional response, frustration, disappointment, self-doubt, sometimes even shame. And what became really clear is that it's not just that we experience these emotions, it's how we've learned to deal with them that's shaped by the cultures we're part of. In academia, we often learn, sometimes implicitly, to move on quickly, not to dwell, to focus on the next submission, the next opportunity. What came through really strongly in those reflections afterwards was the importance of actually pausing and acknowledging those emotional responses. That shift from pushing through to noticing and naming what we're feeling can make a real difference to how we recover and move forward. It was also a really powerful point about how the current culture of academia doesn't always leave much space for vulnerability or reflection. Instead, we can fall into patterns of emotional suppression, comparison, or simply pushing on without processing what happened. And yet, when we do create space, even briefly, for reflection, for sharing, for naming those experiences, something shifts. It becomes less about I failed and more about I'm learning. And for me, that's where this really connects back to everything we've heard across the series. Because we're talking about vision, impact, careers, culture, visibility, these aren't just abstract ideas, they're lived experiences, shaped by environments we're in, the behaviours we see around us, and what's valued or left unsaid. So one of the things I'm taking away from this series is that researcher development is not just about building skills or sharing information. It's about creating space for people to think more deeply about direction, purpose, value and context. And perhaps that's part of what made these sessions resonate. They weren't only offering tools, they were opening up questions that many researchers are already carrying, even if they don't always have the time or space to articulate them. So that just leaves me to say thank you for listening, and I really hope you enjoyed hearing some of these reflections from the colleagues across the series. Take care and goodbye.
Thanks for listening to the Research Culture Uncovered podcast. Please subscribe so you never miss out on our brand new episodes. And if you're enjoying the discussions, give us some love by dropping a 5-star rating and written review, as it helps other research culturists find us. And please share with a friend and show them how to subscribe. Thanks for listening, and here's to you and your research culture.